You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, a look at energy policy. This week, the House passed a tome of an energy bill. It's over 1,000 pages. It's the first major overhaul of energy policy in over 10 years. But the bill is stalled at the Senate at this time by a group of Democrats and Republicans who are unhappy with the new bill. It fell 3 votes short of the 60 needed to push the measure to a final vote. And in the bill is a provision to double the use of ethanol in gasoline. There's a tax credit for buyers of hybrid electric cars, $18 billion in loan guarantees for a natural gas pipeline from Alaska. There's tax breaks for oil, gas, and coal industries, and over $5 billion for renewable energy, wind, solar, and biomass. Something for everyone, or so it seems. Yeah, no one is really overjoyed about this Energy Policy Act of 2003, especially those who don't think this bill does very much to wean the U.S. from its dependence on foreign oil or to speed up the drive to a hydrogen energy economy. So we're going to talk about the bill this hour, if you'd like to talk about the energy bill and what you'd like to see in it. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my first guest. Vijay Vaisathwaran is a global environment and energy correspondent for The Economist magazine and the author of Power to the People, How the Coming Energy Revolution Will Transform an Industry, Change Our Lives, and Maybe Even Save the Planet, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux Books. He joins us by phone from Cambridge. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Let me ask you first, give us your take on this new energy bill from the perspective that you wrote in The Economist last month before the release of the energy bill, that while alternatives to fossil fuels exist, like hydrogen, bioethanol, and energy conservation, that this president and this Congress are not doing much to speed up the transition. And now that the bill is public, it's in Congress, it's stalling. Have you seen anything to change your mind in there?
The fact that there were enough courageous senators that stood up and temporarily put a halt to it today, that's good news. But fundamentally, I think, no, this is a terrible energy bill. It's an example, really, of all that's wrong in not only in how Washington does politics in terms of pork barrel politics, but with how misguided energy policies are in Washington today.
But it's got $300 million for solar programs. It's got $5 billion for renewable energy. If you go to the web pages of the wind energy people who you know, trying to promote that, they say we like this, we should support the bill because it gives us a foot in the door, if nothing else.
This is the problem when you have a foot in the door, but the incumbent technologies not only have both feet, but let's say they have an army of feet in the door, you can never compete. It's a bit like a nuclear arms race. This bill gives the equivalent of $20 billion in subsidies, tax breaks, and other forms of government help for the oil and gas industries. It gives a drop in the bucket to alternatives to oil and gas. So you will never win if you go up against the established incumbents in a subsidy race. That's my point. What we really need is an energy policy that, first of all, isn't premised on the notion that there's a supply crisis. That's really the basis of this policy, that somehow we're running out of oil, we needed to drill in Alaska. Well, thankfully, that provision for oil wasn't there, but we're running out of natural gas, and therefore we have to subsidize a pipeline from Alaska. We're not running out of gas. There's 200 years' worth of natural gas left in the world. We're not running out of electricity either. And the blackouts that we had this year in the Northeast and in California a couple of years ago, well, they weren't caused by a lack of electrons. There's plenty of power. There's a glut in the power building industry, in fact. But this bill hands out loads of money for various forms of power producers, again, using this very bogus assumption of a supply crisis in order to justify handouts to politically connected lobbies.
What about getting us off foreign energy sources and less dependent on them?
This is another one of the great myths in the energy debate today, the idea of energy independence, and especially oil independence. I mean, you take it at face value, it sounds very attractive. Gosh, who wants to be reliant on these very fickle, unsavory, undemocratic Middle Eastern regimes where all, you know, so much of the oil is in the world? Well, that's exactly the point. When you take a look at where is the oil in the world, two-thirds of the world's proven reserves are in Saudi Arabia and the four countries just next to it. The U.S. has only 3% of the world's proven reserves, yet we consume 25% of the world's gasoline. And so if you do the math, we will never be energy independent. We simply use too much oil and sit on top of too little. The right way to think about it is to think about an interdependent world with competitive markets and global trade. Oil is a global commodity, and ultimately, if you really want energy independence, drilling in Alaska or some other part of the protected lands won't make any difference. There's just too little oil to affect the global balance. You need to get off of oil altogether, and that's where the hydrogen vision comes in. There's really it's the first time in 100 years that the internal combustion engine and gasoline, this great iron nexus that's powered the American economy in the last 100 years, but with great environmental damage and great security costs, it's been challenged. And that challenge comes from clean hydrogen fuel and something called the fuel cell, which is a way of using hydrogen fuel very cleanly to move our cars, to power our power plants, even in our laptops. So these will be coming in the next year or two.
But doesn't the bill authorize research to, I mean, we're sitting on a load of coal. Doesn't it authorize spend money on research that would make it, that would clean up the coal and make it suitable for producing hydrogen?
Yes, and this is something. There's a lot of confusion about hydrogen. It's not an energy source. It's a way of, like electricity, it's a fuel that we can use to use energy in a clean way. We make electricity from coal, but we can also make it from nuclear, or we can make it from renewables, which would be very clean and beneficial to the local environment and the global environment in terms of climate change. Likewise, hydrogen, you can make it from coal, you can make it from nuclear power. I don't know why you would, because it'd be very expensive, but Congress wants to throw $2 billion at a nuclear reactor to make hydrogen very expensively in this energy bill, and you can make it from renewables. This is the beauty of something like a hydrogen fuel. It's a zero-emission fuel. If you use coal, there are ways to do it cleanly. You take the carbon out of coal, you sequester it in the ground, carbon sequestration, something that the oil industry does today on a daily basis. And the future might very well have coal as a part of it, a hydrogen future, but only if it's used cleanly, not in the dirty way we use coal today.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring on someone who's based his reputation on a hydrogen economy. Harry Braun is the third is chairman and CEO of Sustainable Partners, the chairman of the Hydrogen Political Action Committee, and advisory board member for the International Association of Hydrogen Energy. He's also the author of The Phoenix Project, Shifting from Oil to Hydrogen with Warp Time Speed. And Harry Braun is running for president. He was running actually for governor of California, and he ran on both. He ran on that platform and on this platform. He's going to be in the primaries in New Hampshire on a hydrogen platform, and he joins us by phone from New Hampshire. Welcome back to Science Friday, Harry.
Thanks for having me back, Ira.
What do you think of this energy bill, as if I have to ask?
I agree with Vijay. It's a terrible bill. It's going in the wrong direction. It's another waste of billions of taxpayers' dollars, and it will create far more problems than it will solve by focusing on new nuclear power plants and focusing on coal and natural gas, frankly.
But Vijay says we can use the coal and make it cleanly.
Well, you have to chop the tops off mountains to do that. And if anybody that's been to a strip mining site to see how we get coal, I don't think would be so anxious to support that. And let me also say that we have about a 250-year supply of coal if we maintain our current level of production. But if you're going to use the coal to run the cars in terms of making hydrogen from it and running the airplanes and running the power plants, then that 250-year supply of coal won't even last 50 years. And you will have devastated much of our country in the process. Mm-hmm. You don't need to do that. It will take decades if you try. It's much easier to mass produce a device like a wind machine that is no more difficult to build than an automobile, and we make 17 million of those every year.
Mm. And in fact, you've come up with an interesting, if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, we've got a picture of your wind ships up there, and you have proposed that we can switch by the year 2010 to a total hydrogen economy by putting these wind chips out in the oceans. Basically, they're units of windmills together, and they can produce hydrogen from the ocean.
That's exactly right, and the reason we want to do that, Ira, isn't that you can't put those 10 million wind machines on land. You can. In fact, farmers make more money off the royalties of the wind machines than they typically do their cattle or their crops. But we have another global serious problem that 90% of the oceans are now dead. They are being hunted into extinction. And
you mean for the fish population?
The fish, not just the fish population, it's all the marine organisms between the trawlers that drag along the seabed floors and these other third world fishing fleets with their 50-mile-long drift nets. They are strip mining the oceans. And in another 5 years, they will be dead. And the only thing that's going to save those oceans is putting a large fleet of these wind ships out at sea which underneath the water in the hull part of the ship, which is where the crew live and work, incidentally, there's the electrolyzers, which also counterbalance the wind array at the top, which for our viewers who can't see this, they need to go to our website to see what a windship looks like. But essentially there's a mast, and instead of sails, there's wind turbines.
Mm-hmm. And it's basically bobbing in the water with,
as you say, underneath
it is like a buoy. It's sitting on a buoy, and then there's a ballast underneath. But the ballast is made up of the machinery that converts the water to hydrogen.
That's correct. And then there's an underwater hydrogen pipeline that comes ashore. And with all that equipment under the water, Ira, you provide a huge sanctuary for the fish and other marine organisms, so that they can survive in an otherwise. They're on the path to extinction, and we need to stop that problem as well.
Well, if you say we can do this by 2010, but how would we be able to convert all the automobiles?
Oh, easily, because we don't need fuel cells at all. The internal combustion engine runs beautifully on hydrogen, and every existing automobile that's ever been produced, whether it's a Model T Ford or a SUV or a Hummer, doesn't matter. You can modify every one of those vehicles and every airplane in the sky to run on hydrogen fuel.
We actually had a gentleman named Roy McAllister, who you're probably familiar with.
I know Roy very well. And yeah, he gives classes to people, and he's got high school kids converting engines to run on hydrogen for about $50.
It doesn't take anything really special to convert your car to run.
No, you don't actually change the bottom end of the engine at all. Typically, what you want to do is just put a different fuel injection system on it so that you can get hydrogen injected directly into the cylinder. And when you do that, you now have a pollution-free car with zero carbon emissions.
Vijay, what do you think of this plan?
Well, there are a couple of things I wanted to take issue with. First of all, the idea of dismissing coal so lightly. I think the nobody disagrees who thinks about hydrogen seriously that the long-term vision is hydrogen based on renewable energy. That could be one of many sources. It may be wind in the short term. It could be sources, biomass in different parts of the world based on what is the cheapest to produce. But I would say the reason, I'll just say it very briefly, China and coal and the carbon shadow that will come from China and India and South Africa, countries that have enormous quantities of coal and that frankly do not really care very much about global warming. They will burn that coal, I would argue, and I do argue in the book, because they're concerned about energy poverty. There are almost 2 billion people in the world without access to modern fuels, things like electricity. They use things like cow dung and very dirty forms of energy today. And as China modernizes, as India and South Africa grow by leaps and bounds, they're going to burn that coal because it's the cheapest energy source available. And frankly, having spent a lot of time in these countries, I know that they care about local pollution, but not so much about climate change. If they use today's coal-burning technologies, which is what they will do, that's going to cast a grave carbon shadow and make it impossible for the rich world to tackle climate change. On the other hand, if we do help develop and buy down the costs for using coal with sequestration in clean ways, in other words, taking the hydrogen from hydrocarbons, trapping the carbon in the ground as through sequestration, and there are a number of different promising technologies for doing this, and it's already being done by the oil and gas industry, by Norway's industry, for example, there's a great example. I think we would really help the poor world leapfrog to the hydrogen age, and that's something we can't discount.
Let me remind everybody, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto, and we're talking with Vijay Vaidyaswaran and with Harry Braun about hydrogen. Harry, how do you answer that?
I think it would be a disaster for Spaceship Earth to continue, much less increase, the use of coal. I think we should be shutting down the existing coal plants in this five-year period. And I might add, we should be shutting down every one of the nuclear plants that, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, are undergoing serious levels of corrosion in their major core cooling systems. And if you have an accident in any one of these plants, it's going to make 9/11 look like a picnic. These are very serious issues, and the thing about these coal and nuclear technologies, they take decades to try to get up and running. But a wind machine is no more difficult to build than an automobile. If you look under the hood, it's got a gearbox, a generator, an electronic control system, and a brake. Every one of those components can be made by GM or Ford, and we only need 10 million units to run the entire United States, producing 100 quads of energy. That's everything we do from coal, natural gas, and these other environmentally destructive fossil fuels. We can do it with the wind machines in just a couple of years because we make 17 million cars every year. So we only need 10 million units, And, of course, we'd probably have to go hire 10 million people in our country to go to work in the shipyards and the aerospace and shipbuilding industries to launch these wind ships like the Liberty ships of World War II.
Why don't you get the auto industry behind you on
this? They will be behind us on this, but right now they're more focused on selling new cars. They're not terribly excited about having us come up and just modify everybody's existing car, which is then going to make the engine last a lot longer because it won't have any of the organic acids and carbon deposits that you get from burning gasoline.
Vijay, any comment?
Sure, absolutely. I think the Harry may be onto a winner with his wind chips, but my advice, at least to folks that think about this area and the lesson to draw from the farce that's happening in Washington, is none of our bets on clean technology, and I don't claim to know the answer as to whether it will be bioethanol or wind chips or some other way of making clean hydrogen. But what I do know is if you get the incentives right, the innovators will come. And it might be Harry with his vision. It might be the GMs of the world that suddenly learn that they can make more money and be more profitable by being green. It might be, you know, the innovators in a basement, the way that the Internet and many of the related technologies with distributed networking, distributed computing came up when we got the innovation right. Today in the energy world, we're not there's no price on carbon, meaning on carbon emissions, on climate change gases. We are going in the wrong direction by subsidizing very dirty, inflexible, centralized modes of energy production like this energy bill does with nuclear subsidies, with oil and gas subsidies. As long as we keep distorting the playing field, the clean innovations, like the sort that Harry and other very inventive people are coming up with, they'll have a really hard time to compete. And I think the most important thing is to get the policy mix right, get the incentives right, and if you send the right signal, we'll see a flurry of innovation that's bigger than the Internet revolution, transforming the energy and environment world.
What kind of signal do you need to send? What kind of incentives?
First of all, we need honest prices. That's the most important thing. Right now, we have extremely dishonest prices in two ways. First of all, it's the cash handout, literally, subsidies. This energy bill is a great example because we can actually look at the numbers and who in what district is going to get $2 billion for a wacky nuclear power plant to make hydrogen. I mean, why? Which farmer in what zip code is going to get how much to grow a very unenvironmentally friendly gasoline additive, ethanol, which is very ungreen the way it's made today? Why are we handing out $2 billion on that? That's one obvious example. But there's a subtler example, and that is the harm done by fossil fuels. The economists like to call it externalities. Harm done to human health, for example. There are externalities relating to the environment, of course, the pollution from fossil fuels, and, of course, the cost of keeping troops in the Middle East and other related costs of keeping the fossil fuel infrastructure going. Well, those prices are not reflected in the price we pay at the pump.
All right, we're going to stop there. I know Harry has some very interesting things to say about that when we come back. So stay with us. We'll come back and talk more about the future of energy, a hydrogen economy, and take some more of your questions. Don't go away. We're talking this hour about energy policy with my guest, Harry Braun III, author of The Phoenix Project, Shifting from Oil to Hydrogen with Warp Time Speed. He's also running for president in 2004. Vijay Vaidheswaran is a correspondent for The Economist magazine, author of Power to the People, How the Coming Energy Revolution Will Transform an Industry, Change Our Lives, and Maybe Even Save the Planet, just out from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux Books. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Harry, I understand that your first act of president will do something, if you're elected president, will be something to basically level the playing field about the price of energy.
Yeah, I think Vijay is exactly right when he points out that if we had a fair accounting system, hydrogen produced by the renewables would be the least expensive fuel that we would buy in a free market economy, and all the oil companies and coal companies would quickly become wind or solar hydrogen companies. Now, I tend to focus on wind because in today's world, those machines, bankers finance them, and they produce electricity for less cost than any other renewable energy technology. So we can talk about solar, but if you talk about photovoltaics, you're not being practical. It's just like fuel cells. They work technically, but they're completely uneconomic, and so it's not worthy of our time to talk about them. Wind machines, on the other hand, have been around for 1,000 years. They work, and if we have a fair accounting system, which is what I call the Fair Accounting Act legislation, which, exactly as Vijay said, stops subsidizing the bad, dirty, non-renewable energy technologies, and then you don't even need to subsidize the clean ones because they'll be cheaper in a free market system.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Ben. And is it Healdsburg, California?
Healdsburg, California.
Healdsburg, sorry.
It's the wine country, and we have a lot of wind here today, so it'd be perfect for some turbines. I did notice that there was a real lack of talk about solar panels, and I was kind of wondering when we might all have a solar panel on our roofs, and, you know, if not, why not? And I heard him say that they're completely uneconomical, but you know, why is that?
Let me just say that in this bill that stalled in Congress, there was an authorization for $300 million for solar programs. And I'm reading from the bill, starting with a goal of installing 20,000 solar rooftop systems in federal buildings by 2010, and a separate $210 million program for concentrating solar power for hydrogen production. Is if we don't get those, you know, that money, is that going to stall solar programs? Vijay, what do you think?
Well, those sorts of programs will help. I mean, there's no doubt if you have a buyer for an expensive technology, especially in early stages, there is an argument for that even many people who are market-minded economists would say there's an appropriate role for government in early-stage research or in helping very in intelligent ways getting technologies closer to market. Now, the right way is probably not for government to pick winners to say, well, you know, we like solar PV that's done in this way, but gosh, you know, we're going to pick this and put all our money in this. There's smart ways to do this, and there's experience in Japan and Europe with doing this, where there's much more experience in trying to promote clean energy. The point I'd make about solar, that there's also room for innovation. The caller asked, you know, what's the problem here? Why aren't we talking about solar? It is more expensive, but let's remember, it's expensive. The way that we do economics and financial calculations on Wall Street, it's expensive as capital cost. It costs a lot to get solar panels, but of course the fuel is free, and if they're good ones, there's not much maintenance involved. That's not true, for example, for natural gas plants, where gas prices are a big part of the overall cost. And now there are very innovative utilities like the one out in Sacramento, the municipal utility, that have realized that consumers will have savings from this, and it's good for the environment, but they might not want to put the money up front. And so they actually help them roll in the cost of solar panels into their mortgage payments so that you pay just a little bit over the life of the mortgage. And that helps consumers realize the benefits over time without needing to fork over a bunch of money up front. And so there are innovations, and they don't only have to do with technology, that can help things like solar take off.
Well, you can see why there are little bits in this bill for everybody. There is a tax credit, a 15% tax credit for homeowners that's up to you can get a tax credit up to $2,000 to buy solar, electric, or hot water systems. And it's the same thing for wind power or fuel cell systems. That's something like almost like what Jimmy Carter was doing back in the 70s.
But let's remember the legacy of the last 25, 30 years on the renewable front is not a very good record. Around the world, only about 1% of the world's commercial energy comes from what are called new renewables, not counting gigantic dams that environmentalists don't like anymore. If we talk about wind or solar or small-scale hydro, it's pretty small. And the main reason is that just throwing subsidies at the problem or at this isn't going to solve the problem. It doesn't do enough. You can't push new technologies only. You need the market pull. And as long as fossil fuel prices are so low, it's going to be and on the powers of incumbency of fossil fuel companies are so great. The resistance from utilities, for example, they like how they do things. Utility engineers don't like distributed generation by and large. They certainly don't like fuel cells and small kind of new innovations, but they're not happy with distributed power options that include solar and some other forms of innovative clean power because, gosh, you know, they have to think about how do you plug it into the grid. It's a threat, actually, to their utility monopoly in many places. And so you have lots of barriers to entry as long as the established system favors the incumbents, which tend to be fossil fuel companies.
Let me go to the phones. Let's go to William in Miami. Hi, William.
Hi. I have a quick question regarding the fuel cells. Namely, is that if pretty much fuel cells are just a battery, a chemical battery, that is seemingly cleaner because it produces water as opposed to hydrocarbons in the air. However, you still need to get that hydrogen from somewhere, which still leaves the question of how do you produce the energy. And pretty much that's the same question we've been asking for ever since the environmental debate over energy production has started. And I think that this is somehow just trying to distract the issue.
Harry Braun has an answer for you. He's got a whole system set up.
You don't have to do any R&D. You just take an existing state-of-the-art wind machine, mass-produce it in the car plants, and then your cost of liquid hydrogen at the pump will be very comparable to the current price of gasoline. Whereas if you use, and incidentally, wind power is an indirect form of solar energy. I mean, it's all part of the solar renewable energy that strikes the earth. The photovoltaic cells, if you make hydrogen with those, you'll be paying 10 times more for the cost of your fuel. For the people that want to do that, that's great. They can do that today. But I'm just saying, to be cost-effective in the real world, wind machines are here now, they're ready to go, and I believe that the damage to the oceans and the atmosphere from all this carbon necessitates moving with wartime speed. I don't think we are like passengers on the Titanic, and we do not have a lot of time to change course for spaceship Earth.
Okay, William?
Well, actually, I had just one thing with the entire, if you, you have existing energy production methods already, and if you change that to actually produce hydrogen in and of itself, then you could actually set up the consumer hydrogen market. And then once you do that, then you could actually talk about moving the actual production of energy towards a cleaner method, because you'll that will not have, it'll be transparent to the consumer. They won't have to then again go out and wait for these production methods to come actually be implemented. And you'll actually have people using hydrogen hydrogen fuel on its own, and then you can deal with the production methods later. That's it.
Okay. Well, Harry or Vijay, you want to answer that?
If I could jump in there.
Sure.
All right.
Go ahead, Vijay.
I think the caller made a very profound observation. Hydrogen is not an energy source. And as he pointed out, hey, you know, we have energy sources already. What's the point here? Why are you doing this? And I think it's important whenever you have talk of radical shifts, you have to put it to the so what test, you know? So what? Why are we doing hydrogen? The only reason to do it is you do have to make it from some other fuel source. The reason is, at the point of use, in a fuel cell, for example, it has no local emissions of any kind, and it doesn't contribute to climate change. There's no other alternative, especially in transportation, where gasoline is the fuel we use today, almost as a monopoly, that can offer you that substitution. And this matters because, again, the caller asked, you know, why would you make it from other energy sources? Well, look at electricity. Electricity is a fuel, an energy carrier in the technical parlance, but it's worth making from other sources because, you know, we're tired of using cow dung in our houses to get heat and light, like 2 billion people in the world have to do today. Nobody in America would put up with that kind of energy carrier. That's why we moved to electricity. It's worth doing. It's completely clean at the point of use, and so too can our cars be. And think of all the urban megalopolises in the developing world, but look at L.A., look at Houston. The idea of urban transport without local pollution and nor contribution to climate change, ultimately, that's the reason to do it. And, you know, the debate about which fuel or which energy source will lead to that hydrogen, I think there will be multiple choices along the road to the utopia of renewables hydrogen. I know that Harry would like to see that by 2010. People who look at the economics of this might say, gosh, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money, some would suggest, especially if I don't hear from Harry, is the cost of scrapping existing capital stock. There is actually a value to the existing plants in energy. Now, you might not like them, but there are people that paid for them, that own them. There are costs of switching that economists would figure into the calculation. And I would suggest that a phased transition would probably make more sense than something like the radical plan that Harry's proposing, but perhaps that's a point we'll have to disagree on.
Let me just remind everybody that they're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Harry, how do you get people to scrap everything we have now? There is a lot of capital and labor
and jobs. No, they
don't
have to scrap it. Ira, they don't have to scrap anything. They need to modify the natural gas plants to just burn hydrogen. Or if it's a coal plant, you can modify the boilers to burn hydrogen. You don't have to scrap them, but you have to stop using dirty fuels. And what the caller doesn't understand is that the hydrogen we have today comes mostly from natural gas, which, contrary to what Vijay says, is in very short supply and is very environmentally destructive to the ranchers and other property owners where these natural gas rigs come on their property and ruin it. There are very high environmental costs that if they were factored into this, we would be using wind machines because they make the most sense. And when you get everybody focused on the right technology that can solve the problems and make things happen, and let me tell you, when you want to talk about costs, Vijay isn't mentioning what the cost of fuel cells are. But General Motors has put out their numbers. They think the fuel cell stack alone will cost over $50,000 to $100,000 per vehicle, assuming they're in high-volume production because of the platinum requirements. And the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences says you'd have to increase world platinum production by a factor of 30. And I don't think very many people seriously think that's a good move. wind machines and internal combustion engines.
I'd have to challenge that figure from
Harry.
Well,
you can challenge it with the association, but I'm just saying that
the internal combustion engine does
the same thing without having everybody scrap all their existing cars and trucks. Internal combustion engines run the world, and they can run it very well on hydrogen.
So you're saying we don't need fuel cells right now? We can go right to just
power. That's exactly right. Forget fuel cells. They are a gimmick that's in the way of progress.
I see. And so if we just change over our cars, our regular cars can burn the hydrogen instead.
That's exactly right.
And put out water out of the tailpipe.
That's right. That's it. You got it.
Vijay?
What's wrong with that? Sure. Very quickly, when you use hydrogen in internal combustion engines, you do not get zero emissions. So it's wrong to suggest that. That's the reason why, if you're concerned about zero emissions.
Well, talk to BMW and Ford and GM. They all say you do.
No. Actually, having just spoken with the chief technology officer at GM a couple of days ago, they tell me their figures that they're using and putting out publicly is $500 a kilowatt for their current PEM fuel cells. Now, you can argue about the numbers, but the order of magnitude is not the one that you suggested. That still doesn't mean we're going to see fuel cells tomorrow. Let's remember that today's internal combustion engine is only about $50 a kilowatt. I mean, we've had 100 years, and the world's best engineers working on it to tinker and make it perfect. So it's going to take quite a lot to get the cost figures, whether it's 500 or 1,000 or 4,000, we can debate. But it's not the kind of order of magnitude difference that Harry's talking about. And that's a figure that's verified by talking to lots of companies in the industry. I still think it will take a long time.
What incentive do the car companies have to come up with fuel cells?
Excellent question. This is what a number of the car companies are seeing. They're seeing great opportunity. The real vision that we're already beginning to see with the Toyota Prius, some of these hybrid cars, is a move towards electric drive vehicles, away from the mechanical drive that's been really the grease and grime workhorse of the last 100 years.
Those are not fuel cell vehicles.
I understand
though,
that, but the control electronics and the electric drive motors and the regenerative braking will be the same as in fuel cell cars.
Right.
So when Ira asked what is the incentive, they see market opportunity, and this is the vision from a number of companies that they see. They see this. Look, there's no reason why these cars can't be plugged into the wall. The fuel cell cars of the future will be the micro power plants of our homes, offices, and they will sell power into the grid while plugged in when you're at work or during the day, making a profit on the spot electricity.
Vijay, Harry, I got to stop it. There's always a lively discussion about fuel. We'll come back and we follow this all the time. So I want to thank you both for joining us. Vijay Vaidheswaran is correspondent for The Economist and author of Power to the People: How the Coming Energy Revolution Will Transform an Industry, Change Our Lives, and Maybe Even Save the Planet, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Harry Braun is basically the author of The Phoenix Project, Shifting from Oil to Hydrogen with Warp Time Speed. He's also running for president in New Hampshire. Earlier we spoke with Denise Fossman. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks, Ira.